Welcome to the Jewish Theological Seminary. My name is David Kramer. I'm director of the library here at JTS, and it is our honor to sponsor book talks through the course of the academic year of a variety of sorts. So that explains why I'm here. We are co-sponsoring this event tonight with the Bloch Kolker Center for Spiritual Arts, and Rabbi Jan Orbach was over there, director of that center. Thank you for co-sponsoring, making this a very wonderful and grander event than most of our book talks. We've got a distinguished panel. I'll introduce everybody before they speak. But I do want to say, my ordinary introduction goes something like this. We take responsibility for bringing to the public books of Jewish interest, new books of Jewish interest, significant new books in Jewish studies, and then I go on from there. I've got to say that tonight, I think it's fair to say, that the book that we are going to be considering and celebrating, given our number and the gathering here, I think it would count as all of the above. It's a book of considerable Jewish interest to circles beyond those of the involved in the specific scholarship of Kabbalah and the Zohar. It is an absolutely magnificent book. I read it in this version, right? And you can see, you know, the yellow sticky things, which are the many, many places that I know that I want to go back to. The panelists, who are more expert than I am in this particular field, will tell me whether my judgment is incorrect. My guess is that it isn't, but it seems to me that this is a very significant new contribution to this field related to other fields of Jewish studies and academic studies beyond, and it truly is a work that deserves to be celebrated. That's why you're here, and so I'm going to go directly to the first of our presenters, Professor Larry Fine, who is Professor Emeritus at Mount Holyoke, and one of his specialties is in this field, as is true in direct and less direct ways of all of our panelists. So, Professor Fine.
Good evening. It's a great personal pleasure to be here this evening and to participate in a celebration of Professor Eitan Fishbein's new work of scholarship, The Art of Mystical Narrative, A Poetics of the Zohar. I have followed Eitan's work closely over the years, including this particular grand project nearly from its beginnings. And I've had the good fortune to co-edit a book with him and to collaborate on other scholarly projects, including a volume of essays that I'm currently editing. I hope that Eitan's parents, who are also friends, won't mind if I share a little of the nachas that so richly accompanies this occasion. I take that as a yes. On originality, it's hard to know where to begin to talk about Eitan's work. This is the case not merely by virtue of its length, but more importantly, by virtue of its extraordinarily ambitious and vast conceptual, intellectual, and substantive scope. Needless to say, the notion of summarizing its contents is beyond my 15 minutes. That said, Eitan himself does a perfect job of this in a concise way at the end of his book, and I want to quote the opening paragraph of his concluding remarks. It serves to convey to us the essential nature of his work, and I hope it will help our audience gain a small sense of what is at stake here. Quote, "In this book, I've studied the Zohar as a work of literature, seeking to understand the ways in which this corpus should be appreciated, not only as a masterpiece of Jewish thought, theology, and exegesis, but also as a great achievement of the Jewish narrative imagination. Presenting a poetics and morphology of Zoharic storytelling, I've approached the text less from the vantage point of the history of ideas and more through the phenomenology of literary forms. In short, I've set out to read the Zohar through the eye of the literary critic, employing methodologies anchored in the terrain of narrative studies, hoping to see new horizons through the nexus of religion and literature. What is more, I have argued that the Zohar should be recovered as a pillar of Jewish aesthetics, of the dynamic relationship between narrative art and the mystical imagination, end quote. I wish to draw attention to the words hoping to see new horizons in this statement. Works of scholarship are sometimes referred to as pathbreaking or pioneering, and often this language is more hyperbole than it is fitting. But there is no hyperbole in calling Fishbane's work pathbreaking. I say this not necessarily to offer praise, although I will offer some praise, but rather to make an important point about the book. Nothing quite like this work has been written. In his introduction, Eitan appropriately acknowledges and reviews earlier Kabbalistic scholarship that has ventured into similar territory as his own. In a completely gracious manner, he recognizes the important work of others in helping him imagine and think through his own project. Indeed, the book is in very significant ways a lively conversation with other distinguished scholars in this country and in Israel. But in my view, Eitan's hoping to see new horizons has been altogether realized in this work of great originality. That is to say, the sweeping scope, the broad intellectual frameworks, and the conceptual and methodological sophistication that Eitan has brought to this project will enable readers to see new horizons for many, many years to come. As is true of genuinely important works of scholarship, I have no doubt that it will generate much new scholarship in its wake. It will not just be endlessly cited. It will inspire others, especially those new to the field, to view the Zohar and certain other works of Kabbalah as works of literary art. It is, in other words, door opening. In this connection, Fishbane aptly notes that Kabbalistic scholarship has begun to join biblical and rabbinic studies, among others, in forging literary approaches to religious texts. On the question of the appeal of the Zohar, one of the very most central questions underlying this project for Eitan has to do with how the Zohar appealed to so many, in so many different places, across the Jewish world through centuries. What is so compelling about it that it alone joined a very small group of canonical Jewish religious texts, if not for all Jews, then certainly for a great many? Fishbane navigates this question in various ways, including raising the question of what it means to be or to become a classic work of literature. In the case of the Zohar, it is precisely its various poetic qualities that help us make sense of this appeal. Let me again quote a few words by Eitan on this question. Quote, "There is something sublime that is revealed in a great work of art, a transformation of consciousness that allows, perhaps even requires, each reader to re-fathom its depths. With regard to the Zohar, we might say that the poetic image or symbol incarnates an ineffable dimension of being, evoking the mystery and meaning of existence through the eruption of the beautiful. I suggest that it is this very event of wonder and otherworldly presence that most vividly account for the power and hold it has exerted upon its readers throughout the generations," end quote. Of course, all this begs the question as to how exactly the Zohar manages to rise to this level. Much of the art of mystical narrative, it seems to me, is in effect in the service of responding to this question about the appeal and reception of the Zohar. The particular nature of the Zohar's poetic language, the dramatic and emotional intensity of its narratives, its mysterious figures who implausibly emerge as repositories of profound wisdom, its sense of wonder and spontaneity, its dialectical tension between the concealed and the revealed, its fictional imagining of the geography of the land of Israel, its employment of a rich and often fantastically fanciful Aramaic, its fictive setting in the time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, its journeys into magical realism, its endlessly rich array of images and mythologies, its openness in embracing the mysteries of evil and of the erotic, the mystery of a multi-limbed gendered god, its ethical and impersonal sensibilities. All these and more are grist for Fishbane in scrutinizing the question of the Zohar's appeal, all through the lens of narrative theory and criticism. I believe it's worth noting that historically, There was no single way in which the Zohar exerted its appeal. When we examine the historical development of Kabbalah in the wake of the Spanish expulsion, what we see is a gradual dissemination and relative popularization of Kabbalah, especially the Zohar. What had once been strictly esoteric, only transmitted in closed circles from teacher to disciple, beginning in the 13th century, over time became more widely accessible. This occurred in significant part through the printing revolution in the middle of the 16th century in northern Italy, with two competing editions of the Zohar published at just about the same time at Cremona and Mantua. With respect to the Zohar, different communities in different cultural settings related to it in different ways. For example, Middle Eastern Jews believe that simple daily recitation of the Zohar, without necessarily studying its meaning, was a critical form of ritual devotion. North African Jews believe that just having a copy of the Zohar in their home or in the synagogue would protect their families from harm. Some festively celebrated the Zohar at the grave of Shimon Bar Yochai at Meron on Lag BaOmer, as they still do to this day. Others heaped upon it commentary after commentary, expanding its very scope. While in 18th century Eastern Europe, portions of Zohar were rendered into Yiddish, the vernacular for women and so-called ordinary men. Reading Eitan's book makes me wonder how the narrative features of the Zohar that form the subject of his work played a role in the different ways in which the Zohar became so important to so many. It is, of course, a matter of great paradox that a work originally defined by its esoteric nature eventually became the prerogative of greater and greater circles of individuals and communities. What happens when an esoteric work, replete with the features mentioned above, become more familiar and more accessible? Does it retain the mystery and wonder that lies at its heart? Speaking of our own time, what happens, for example, when it is translated into English? In the era of Daniel Matt's magnificent, poetically rich translation of the Zohar, does the Zohar lose some of its mystery, or does it retain it? On deploying a narrative lens. As we have seen, the essence of this book is in its study of the literary and narrative strategies of the Zoharic text. Fishbane accomplishes this by way of deploying an impressive array of theoretical and methodological questions and approaches. In addition to purely literary ones, including comparative literature, he casts an exceedingly wide net, drawing upon all manner of fields of study: history, philosophy, linguistics, and comparative religion, among others. But with respect to his primary methodological toolbox, the justification, so to speak, for employing literary analysis in a text such as the Zohar is premised on the confidence that asking questions of this type will open up the text in ways that would otherwise not be possible. It is a way of seeing the text through a very particular lens, enabling us to get inside the text in a distinctly intimate way. It seems to me that to do this well, as Eitan assuredly has, requires a heightened psychological and interpersonal astuteness, insofar as deconstructing a complex story involves viewing it from the different points of view of its protagonists. It requires, as it were, seeing the world as others see it. Conclusions. The breadth and depth of the art of mystical narrative is such that it manages to represent the state of the art in Zohar scholarship as a whole. A careful reading of this book invites the reader not only into the colorful world of the Zohar itself, but also into the complex and interesting world of Kabbalistic scholarship about the Zohar and related subjects. Just about every scholarly question currently contested among Zohar scholars, as well as new discoveries, new subjects of inquiry, and much more, find their way into Eitan's work. The notes alone are a treasure trove, pointing the way to multiple worlds of scholarship. It may seem an unusual thing to say, but there is an instinct for thoroughness and comprehensiveness to Eitan's approach to his scholarship that is striking. I'm tempted to say that for those seeking to come up to speed on the past 35 years or so of Zohar scholarship, it could serve as one-stop shopping. And I believe I'm not getting any royalties when I say that. Finally, I want to add a word about the manner of writing in this book. It is an example of pure scholarly writing that is at the same time marked by an evident appreciation, excitement, and warmth towards its subject. This is a very delicate thing to do well, and Eitan has done it with great elegance. When I say that this was a brilliant book, I mean it in the literal sense of that word, namely that it is indeed full of great light. Eitan, it is a pleasure to wish you yasher koach on this truly great achievement, and may you go from strength to strength.
Larry, thank you so much. Before I introduce the next speaker, I just want to correct something that I neglected to do in my introduction. I was so excited to introduce the work and the panel that I neglected to point out that we are not alone in this room. There is an audience also following on live stream. And so those of you who are participating remotely, I especially want to welcome you into the room and thank you for joining us. Our next speaker is Professor Sharon Corin of HUCJIR.
Hello, good evening. I have to say that it is such a pleasure to be invited to speak at JTS. I wrote much of my dissertation in the now non-existent, soon to be recreated library, and it is really a pleasure to speak here. So thank you very much. And it is especially a pleasure to speak, to participate in this panel in celebration of Eitan's work. Eitan and I met, seems like 100 years ago, on the third floor of Art Green's house in Newton, where he would run, he would have a Thursday evening seminar on whatever topic grabbed him in that specific semester. And I'd have to leave every evening at 10 o'clock to get home to that redhead over there in the corner when she was a baby. So that just shows you how long ago it was. I mentioned Art Green, and I'd like to begin by repeating one of his observations. It's not a direct quote, but Art Green notes that where contemporary medieval Christians tried to convey God's majesty through painting or sculpture, or stained glass, or monumental cathedrals, Jewish tradition limited Zoharic, limited mystics to words. And so that the Zoharic authors only had words. But if you listen very carefully or you read very carefully, the Zoharic language creates a virtual kaleidoscope in our minds, as brilliant as the stained glass in the Cathedral of Laon. And the Zohar's poetry makes our spirits fly as high as the buttresses in the Cathedral of Burgos. And in the art of mystical narrative, a poetics of the Zohar, Eitan Fishbane guides us through the architecture of the Zoharic narrative. Eitan demonstrates how Zoharic narrative and exegesis are inseparable and interdependent. And so that which takes place on the fictional plane is the stimulus for what is developed in the Kabbalistic homily. This book is an extraordinary accomplishment, and there are so many things that I love about this book. And so there are just certain things in broad strokes, and I hope this is not gonna sound like a bar mitzvah speech, okay? First of all, I've had the sclut of reading it. You have the sclut of, I'm not being paid, buying it after the talk. But the language that Eitan uses is truly astonishing. He not only is writing about the artistry of the Zohar, but the very language he uses to describe the Zohar is poetic. It is so clear that you are a scholar of literature and you've internalized that into your own writing. I have to say there are so many, I spoke to Eitan yesterday and there were so many little locutions that he makes in his book that I actually wrote down because they were so fabulous. One of my favorites is that the Zoharic soliloquy is the equivalent of a cinematic voiceover. I mean, just fabulous. In addition to that, Eitan makes his arguments so clearly. It's a mark of what I'm sure is true, that you are a masterful teacher in the classroom as well as on the page. And this book is going to be incredibly valuable to layperson and scholar of mysticism alike. And let me just say one more thing. One, you know, mirabile dictu, and here I am, you know, using Latin. The book is jargon-free. In fact, it's one of the few books on Kabbalah that only has one word that is not part of my active vocabulary, and I'm probably going to pronounce it incorrectly, anagnorisis. Is that how you pronounce it? And he explains what it means right away, so you don't have to guess. You don't have to look it up. And in addition, one of the other things that's so extraordinary for this book, for students and scholars alike, is that even though now we have many translations of the book available, of the book of the Zohar that are now available, Eitan Oliver's own poetic translations. I mean, he may consult with Daniel Math translations, and he'll always acknowledge that he does, but he has really written his own translations and done that extra work. And the other thing that's going to be great for scholars is that he provides the translation side by side with the original Hebrew and Aramaic. So when we assign this to students, it's going to be a mechaya for them because they can just practice their translation side by side. So there are so many wonderful aspects about Eitan's book, and I don't remember how many pages there are, but I think there are around 380, not counting notes or indexes. So I obviously can't comment on all of them, but I'm going to take the advantage of the fact that I have the mic to tell you about what excited me the most about Eitan's work, and it probably reflects my own academic interests. And that is, I personally am very curious about the ways in which the experience of living in medieval Castile influenced Zoharic literature. And I would like to note three examples from Eitan's, from the, you know, many possibilities in Eitan's work, in which Eitan places the Zoharic narrative in the medieval and cultural context. By the way, I'm okay, it's okay, we're on a first name basis, right? Okay, all right. So, and I just like to say what, just as an aside, as a sidebar, I just like to say what guts it has to do what Eitan has done in his book, because for those of you who are not in the field, there has been a seismic shift in the Zohar studies, a shift that Eitan, again, in a very poetical way, euphemistically refers to as the destabilizing of recent Zohar studies. And that destabilization, essentially, I'll regalachad on one foot, is that scholars have now argued that the Zohar did not become a book, that we can't refer to as Sefer HaZohar until it was printed in Mantua, a Cremona, in the 16th century. So then what the heck are we all doing in medieval studies? How can we say anything with any assurance about the text as well? And one of the things that I love is that Eitan gives us all the chizuk to write about the Zohar when he says, and I'm quoting, that we nevertheless productively read and interpret the narratives as they came to be inscribed in the cultural canon many generations after their fragmented composition in the 13th and 14th century Castile. And what I think that Eitan has showed in his book, that in fact many of those fragments have to have been the product of 13th and 14th century Castile. So no matter what happened to them later, or how they coalesced later in the 16th century, Eitan has shown on the basis of his close analysis of the narrative context, the narrative framework, that they were a product of the 13th and 14th centuries. So first of all, these are the three pieces that I'd like to describe, and let me know if I'm going too long. Okay, so first, Eitan talks about how frame narratives in general would have been a known convention to medieval readers and to Jews in Iberia in particular. And so first of all, we have the very fact that there is a convention, and even if one wanted to argue that the Zohar itself or the frame narratives of the Zohar are not a construction of the 13th and 14th century, it's a stronger argument because, as we know, frame narratives in Chaucer and Boccaccio were a little later as well. So it's that that piece stands up to all measures of arguments. Another point that Eitan makes, which is a really important point, is that medieval drama, like medieval visual arts, was highly symbolic. And he argues that the Zohar itself should be read as if it's a dramatic narrative, so that the narrative fragments of the Zohar we can imagine as if they would be acted out. And Eitan explains that the actions of these characters in the frame narrative can be read through their gestures, like people would read gestures in a liturgical drama or in a medieval painting. You know, you all know, like, if Jesus has his hands up like this, he's ready to start speaking. So in the Zohar, if one of the characters is weeping, or if the characters are walking, or if a character begins to lie prostrate, or if the character lays on hands, or if the character takes a seat after a walk, we can read different clues into the emotional state of that character, or what we can anticipate or gain insight into what the homily would be saying. And so this is one of the things that I love about the book, because it's as if he's taken the different clues that we have in a Talmudic sugya, like Detanya. We know that it's katuv bebraita, that it's written in a braita, and here he applies that to medieval gestures, which would have been a way that the Zohar, or at least people in the 13th and 14th century, would have read drama as well. The other thing that I love about Eitan's book is he talks about something that we don't really, or at least scholars of the Zohar don't really speak about. And this is, as I told him yesterday, something that I'm definitely gonna teach next semester in my Zohar class at HUC. And that is, he devotes an entire chapter to ethics in the Zohar. And he talks about how the frame narrative reinforce ethics and spiritual ideas in the 13th and 14th centuries. I'm sorry, I'm just going to. So, for example, as he uses, and this is his language, not mine, he talks about the dialectics of disguise and how one should not be too quick to judge others. So we have this convention of the wise fool, and so we should learn ethics from that and not take not read a book by its cover. He talks about the importance of forgiveness in the Zoharic narrative, and this is just fabulous and shows you the breadth of his knowledge, because in his piece on the importance of forgiveness and the importance to repent, Eitan does not only rely on the Zoharic narrative, but actually has done the homework and looked at the general Historia of Alfonso the Wise, Alfonso the X, which is written in extremely difficult Castilian, by the way, and he shows that there is a parallel between the way Joseph is shown or described as being a paragon of forgiveness in that contemporary Christian work and in the Zohar. He also talks about the idealization of poverty and charity in the Zohar. And though Yitzhak Ber had talked about how this idealization of poverty may be influenced by the Franciscan movement, Eitan takes it further and argues from within as well, and argues that poverty was idealized in the Zohar precisely because if you were poor, you are freer of your bodily prison. You don't have as many accoutrements, so your soul must be closer to God. Just another example that I really like that is extremely timely, which is the midah of controlling one's anger. In an example that Eitan brings, and I think that this is the only example that you have in the book of the Zohar speaking directly to us, the narrative speaking directly to us, the Zohar addresses us directly and tells us that anger rips us apart, and that it allows the Sitra Achra, the demonic other side, to inhabit us, and it's akin, or giving into anger is like giving into idolatry. So One of the things that I noted that I'd like to contribute for your next edition of the book is you note, which is extremely interesting, he says, and I'm quoting, the ethical ideas that are sometimes part of Zoharic theology are articulated without a clear connection to Kabbalistic symbolism. And this is I think, the only narratives that you give that are not integrated into the homily. And I would like to suggest, and I don't know if this is true, and again, this is, you know, just conjecture, that this emphasis on ethics may also have to do with the convention of the Summa Confessorum that were popular in the 13th and 14th century, predominantly after the Fourth Lateran Council, which decreed that people needed to confess once a year. So there were these handbooks that priests would read that would tell them how their congregants or parishioners would have to live an ethical life. So it's possible that there's a connection there. Okay, lastly, I'd like to reflect on a moment that had me, you know, almost drop the book because it was so exciting for me. Eitan revisits what is probably the most famous Zoharic story. Indeed, I once had a student who went to Brandeis, and she took two courses in Kabbalah, and then she came to HUC. And she said, "Is this the only story that's ever been translated into English? So Zoharic story translated into English. And of course, it's the story of the old man and the beautiful maiden. This is a story that probably people in this room have written articles about. And if they haven't written articles about, they could list around 10 articles written about it. Eitan found one of its sources from 100 years before. I'm just going to give you the name of the source, the Sefer Shashuim. Just an example of how one can look at a source that just is in your face almost every day if you're a scholar of Kabbalah and just infuse it with new meaning. So anyway, since my time is up, I'll just say Yashar Koach.
Thank you, Sharon, for helping us understand the book. Our last presenter before Eitan's response is our own Professor David Roskies, who last time I checked was not actually a Zohar scholar, but he is a scholar of literature and therefore a very important respondent as well.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who are watching live stream, you should know the room is full. And a measure of the greatness of this book is that there is almost no overlap between the three speakers. It's as if we're all speaking about a different book, which is wonderful. Gershom Scholem once joked that the best novel ever written about Shabtai Tzvi, the false messiah, was Scholem's own two-volume historical biography. But it is no joke to say that The Art of Mystical Narrative is a novel about the making of the Zohar, the central repository of Jewish messianic dreams. On one level, it's a novel about a band of brothers who are feverishly engaged in time travel, their diasporic gaze fixed on a time and place of great antiquity. With intense yearning, they reimagine themselves as ancient sages speaking the vernacular of second century Galilee, a place where miracles were wrought not just for the people Israel, but also, as others claim, for Christendom. At the same time, it is a novel firmly situated in the Iberian landscape, where Arabic and Spanish are the languages spoken and read, and most startling of all, where there is an enlightened monarch called King Alfonso X, whose cameo appearances keep driving the plot. At one point, it is King Alfonso who appoints the great Kabbalist Todros Abulafia as supreme elder of his court, which translates into chief rabbi. And later on, we learn of the bold hypothesis that it was Abulafia's failed messianic strivings in 1290 that endowed the character of Shimon bar Yochai, the hero of the Zohar, with such messianic urgency. So the reader must follow not one, but multiple plots. Plot number one is about Shimon Bar Yochai, fondly known as Rashbi, a saintly, messianic, semi-divine preacher wandering about the ancient Galilee with his band of disciples, and whose dramatic death is presented as the theatrical climax of a sacred narrative. If this sounds suspiciously like the Christian Gospels, then you are the ideal reader, already alive to the second plot line. Plot number two is about the visionary landscape of the medieval Castilian Kabbalists, how they commune with the spirits of the dead saints, their impulse to reveal Kabbalistic secrets, their own desire to forge a Hevraya, a mystical fraternity, and about their Christian surroundings, similarly populated by saints, sinners, pilgrims, hermits, mystics, and holy men. The two plots run parallel and also intersect with one another. Inasmuch as the Zohar is highly episodic, meandering, and pastoral, set in ancient Galilee, so the plot pieced together in the art of mystical narrative is a quest for visionary secrets set in the ancient peaks and underground caves of northern Castile. By default and by design, these two narratives mirror one another, with the same castles, roadside inns, and itinerant beggars mounted on donkeys appearing in both. But there is more. In addition to the dialogue that the medieval Kabbalists conducted with the rabbis of old, and the dialogue that the same Kabbalists conducted amongst themselves, there is a third meta-discursive dialogue that runs through the art of mystical narrative. For the contemporary reader, it is arguably the most exciting of all, because it engages us in dialogue with the world of Zohar scholarship. Reading this book, I was reminded of the intro to biology for non-science majors in my freshman year at Brandeis. The field of biology was changing so rapidly in the late 60s that there was no textbook the professor could assign. So our whole syllabus consisted of articles from Scientific American and other popular science magazines. So too, virtually on every page of The Art of Mystical Narrative, the reader learns about yet another discovery, hypothesis, critical breakthrough in the study of the Zohar, beginning, of course, with the epic-making publication of the Pritzker edition of the Zohar under the editorship of Danny Matt. Until the Pritzker edition, the Zohar was a closed book. I know this from personal experience. When Larry Fine, Danny Matt, and I were in Chavurat Shalom, the Zohar was studied only early in the morning by a tight group of initiates, and I was not one of them. But in The Art of Mystical Narrative, Eitan Fishbein's approach is to be very inclusive. Early on, he reviews the scholarly debate over the admissibility of the Pritzker edition into the Zoharic canon. On a practical level, he asks, can a composite of the best reading possible of the Zohar replace the canonical, badly edited editions? On a methodological level, are we finally ready to jettison the historical positivism of the Wissenschaft des Judentums? Invoking the authority of Danny Matt, the author rules as follows. Just as the Zohar itself is a new ancient text, so it is permissible to produce a copy that is better than the original, which in turn becomes our new improved Sefer HaZohar. Where variant readings are relevant to understanding a given passage, they're given in footnotes. Danny Matt is only one of literally 100 scholars, young and old, living and dead, male and female, Israeli and American, who populate the pages of this book. The book is alive with their voices. And don't think they are shunted aside to the footnotes, because they are not. Eitan is a master of what I call the politics of citation, deciding who is mentioned in the body of the text and who is relegated to the footnotes. Eitan is generous to a fault. They appear both above and below. Of course, he rounds up the usual suspects, Gershom Scholem, Yitzhak Baer, Moshe Idel, whose scholarship is still indispensable. But he adds to their number the new critic of modern Hebrew literature, Mati Meged, whom he discovers to have pioneered the literary approach to the Zohar. Then the fun begins. The reader experiences the dramatic unfolding of Zohar studies in the 21st century through the drama of Eitan Fishbein engaging the thought of Yonatan Ben Arosh, Yehuda Libes, Ronit Meroz, Chaviva Pedaya, Elliot Wolfson, and many, many more. Is the Zohar a Roman Aklef? It was the Israeli scholar Chaviva Pedaya who came up with the bold hypothesis that Abu Lafia's failed messianic strivings in 1290 gave rise to the messianic urgency in the character of Shimon Bar Yochai. Her colleague, Ronit Meroz, likewise suggested that the fictional figures of Chamnuna Sava and his son, the Yunuka, the original child prodigy, were based on real-life figures in 13th and 14th century Iberia. Meanwhile, Ellen Haskell wrote a whole book on the Zohar's Conversations with Christianity, in which she reads Shimon Bar Yochai as a counterpoint to Jesus of Nazareth. Relegated to a brief footnote, it would seem that Eitan is not sanguine about this reading. A Roman Aklef? Maybe. A systematic counter-narrative? Probably not. What came first, the epic narrative stratum of the Zohar, its master plot of the teacher-disciple relationship, or the exegetical mystical passages? By the time he poses this question, it is no longer theoretical, because with a firm and patient hand, Eitan Fishbein has already guided us through numerous pericopes, a word we at Chavurat Shalom first learned from his father, Michael Fishbein. Eitan has already taught us to identify when narrative ends and exegesis begins, and where there is a threshold utterance on the border between narrative and exegesis. So he redirects the question of what came first into an intimate conversation with Ronit Meroz, who put this question on the scholarly agenda. Conducted in a lengthy footnote, the conversation ends with Meroz admitting that she doesn't know the answer either. In this way, the huge scholarly apparatus of this book, rather than weigh it down, evolves into a dynamic, open-ended conversation as unfinalizable as the Zohar itself. What is the intentionality of a particular literary form? Did the Iberian Kabbalists know what they were doing? Does it conform to our Western notions of plot, character, drama, realism? How does Eitan Fishbein even come to be asking such questions? Eitan makes no secret of the fact that he is a student of the new school of literary analysis that came to fruition in the journal Proof Texts, a journal of Jewish literary history, founded here at JTS by Alan Mintz and myself in 1981. Proof Texts was a utopian project to map the Jewish literary imagination from ancient times until the present. From the outset, Proof Texts took on big tent topics that represented Jewish culture as continuous, cumulative, and renewable. Jewish responses to catastrophe, medieval Jewish literature, images of women in Jewish literature, the theory and practice of translation, reading through the lens of gender, and most capaciously, the Jewish anthological imagination, guest edited by David Stern. And so it was when Alan and I stepped down as editors-in-chief and a younger cohort took over that Proof Texts published the first collection of essays on Jewish mystical text as literature, in which Eitan Fishbein's The Scent of the Rose was the centerpiece. It was subtitled Drama, Fiction, and Narrative Form in the Zohar. Here was a scholarly agenda as revolutionary as it was restorative. If the classics of Jewish culture were to yield their mystical secrets, then the first step was to subject them to the tools of modern literary analysis. The first step was to read from the inside out. As late as 1963, Saul Bellow opened his paperback collection of great Jewish short stories with the Book of Tobit from the Apocrypha. This is because he was still reading from the outside in. He needed to prove that ancient Jews could write fiction as terse and sexually charged as the stories of Guy de Maupassant. But when a rose is not a rose, when it is a symbolic referent for the female Shechina, then something very different is at stake. What's at stake, according to Eitan Fishbein, is a restless search for refractions of divine wisdom in the earthly realm. Then it becomes the task of literary historical analysis to help train the eye of spiritual sight. It becomes the task of the modern scholar to restore the sacred immediacy of the Zohar. This is the spiritually charged language used by Eitan Fishbein himself. Then what is the Zohar's particular literary form? Shall we rest our case with fragmentary epic, magic realism? As you can tell from my remarks, reading The Art of Mystical Narrative has awakened a whole array of associations in my mind and allowed all kinds of synapses to snap into place. The more I read, the more I was reminded of a brilliant synoptic essay by the late Marshall Berman, a Marxist critic who once lived just above Allan Mintz on West End Avenue. The title says it all: A Little Child Shall Lead Them, the Jewish Family Romance from Samuel to Call It Sleep. Let me be clear, he meant the biblical Book of Samuel and the modernist classic by Henry Roth. By Jewish family romance, Berman meant a story in which basic family relationships are loaded with metaphysical intensity and are felt to form the ultimate core of being. Or, in simpler terms, Jewish happiness is typically family happiness. To be sure, the mystical fellowship described in the Zohar is androcentric. Except for the Shechina, an innkeeper's daughter, and the Shunammite woman from 1 Kings 4, it is a world devoid of women. And Eitan is none too happy about it. Yet the art of mystical narrative is alive with father-son, master-disciple relationships that are nothing if not fraught with passion and eros, abiding love and acts of bonding. In the mystical family constellation, the most marginal figures are the most valued. The Yanuka, the baby in his cradle, who is the source of ultimate wisdom, and the grandfather figures like Rav Hamnuna Sava, who reveals himself to be the inner Zoharic memory bank. One grandfather, the Saba de Mishpatim, has a whole book named after him. So let me leave you with this thought. When read through a particular literary lens, The Art of Mystical Narrative is a Jewish family romance twice over. Just as the mystical fellowship of the Rashbi and his disciples, of the fathers and sons, the Yanukas and Sabas, is one messianically happy family, so too are the generations of scholars, both living and dead, whom Eitan Fishbein has assembled in this capacious, magnificent book, which, by no coincidence, he has dedicated to his own father.
And the time has come. I don't need to introduce our next speaker.
Good evening, friends. It's very moving to me to see so many esteemed colleagues and friends here tonight to celebrate this work of many years. And I want to thank you all for taking the time to be here, as well as to all of you who are watching on the live stream and other locations. I'm particularly grateful to my colleagues, Professors Fine, Corin, and Roskies, who so generously took the time and care to read and respond to my work. I am deeply honored and moved by your words tonight, and I offer you my most heartfelt thanks. A big thank you as well to Professor David Crane, librarian of JTS, for moderating and hosting this event, and to Mr. Hector Guzman for expertly arranging all the many logistical details for this evening. I'm likewise very grateful to Rabbi Jan Urbach and the Block Kolker Center for Spiritual Arts at JTS for generously co-sponsoring this event. And on a personal note, it's a special pleasure for me to be able to recognize and welcome my parents, Mona and Michael Fishbane, my brother, Alicia Russ Fishbane, and my wife, Julia Andelman. It means a great deal to me that you are all here tonight. It is powerful to me to mark the occasion of my book's publication in this way, given that the birthing of this project into the world feels like a liminal moment in my career and in my development as a scholar and a teacher. And it's wonderful to do this at JTS, my intellectual home now for more than 12 years. Scholarship, as so many of you know, is often a deeply solitary endeavor. So it's a special pleasure to be able to cultivate moments of conversation about that work with fellow scholars, students, and interested readers. In many ways, this book has been brewing within me for most of my adult life. Ever since my very first forays into the Zohar as a college student at Brandeis, at a time when I was also captivated by the presence of mystical and spiritual themes in English and American poetry. This project, therefore, flowed from the grounding insight that mystical speech may be characterized as a kind of metaphysical prose poetry, the attempt, like those of so many other poets, to give artistic voice to the transcendent reverberations of spiritual feeling and thinking. The Zohar, in its rich mythopoetic speech, evokes the mysteries of divinity with a lyric rhythm, an interpretive brilliance, and an imaginative depth unparalleled, I dare say, in all the rest of Jewish religious literature and thought. A little biased. As we have already heard here tonight, those discourses of mystical theology and midrash are framed within the great story of a fictionalized Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his disciples on their wandering quest through a reimagined ancient Galilee. My book seeks to zero in on this narrative dimension of the Zohar, to study this major piece of the Zohar as fiction, through the manifold lenses of literary studies. And while the poetic features of the Zohar are considered at various points in the book, I decided to make the focus of this study be the fictional storytelling forms of the Zohar, the episodic and sometimes fragmentary way that the sojourn and the quest for hidden meaning by the mystic characters is constructed and represented in the text. Thus, my work studies this masterpiece of Kabbalah through an interdisciplinary prism. through the nexus of two often separated fields of inquiry, the study of religion and the study of literature, or more specifically, and maybe a little bit jargony, the phenomenology of mysticism and narrative form criticism. Though Kabbalah has long been seen in relation to medieval Jewish philosophy, my research has sought to recover the deep lines of connection between the Zohar and the study of Jewish literature. So since you have now heard quite a bit about the book from my distinguished colleagues, and in the spirit of literary events, I'll now read a few passages aloud so you can get a further flavor for the book and also to hear some of the words in the voice of their author. So this is from the beginning of chapter one, called Voice, Gesture, and Drama, and really tries to evoke that dramatic, theatrical, performative texture that Professor Corin was talking about, that Sharon was talking about. At the core of my approach to the Zohar is the claim that the text may be read as a kind of dramatic literature, a narrative world in which the power of esoteric wisdom and the brilliance of its disclosure are presented and theatricalized for the reader. Within this performative framework, the intimate and reverential relationship between the master and the disciples is on display, and the fictional scenes serve as the context in which the homiletical mysticism is delivered and received. Such is the shifting stage light of Zoharic discourse, the weave by which the authors take us in and out of exegetical thought patterns. This dimension of the text should be seen in the larger context of medieval frame narratives, a convention of the intersecting literary worlds into which the Zohar was born. So in this next passage, also from the same chapter, starting on page 76, where in the context of what will be a kind of mystical homiletical reflection on the nature of midnight, the study of mystical secrets in the middle of the night, and the power of the setting sun and all of its mythic drama. I quote this text. It has been taught, Rabbi Elazar said, at the beginning of the first hour, when day expires and the sun sinks, and the master of keys who is appointed over the sun enters through the 12 gates that are open during the day. And some of this translation is definitely indebted to Daniel Matz. Magisterial translation, though it's also mine. After he enters through all of them, all those gates are closed. A crier arises and begins to proclaim, "The one who rises, rises and grasps those keys." When the crier finishes, all the guardians of the world assemble and ascend, no one opening a portal, all calming down. Mystified. Here, now this is me. Here we see the mythic poetry of the Zohar at play. The wonder of sunset is evoked through an aesthetics of metaphor. The energies of day released like the outflow of breath. the sun entering below the border of visible horizons. The texture of daytime is portrayed as a series of gates, openings in the fabric of reality. And the master of keys is the rhythm of light personified and hypostasized. The very cadence of the text beats with the drum of evening mystery. We are drawn into the wonder and majesty of the hour. Indeed, it is represented first as the calming down of the natural and supernatural realms, the peace of sunset, the glow of the sun in descent. The text then continues to portray a rich vision of the cosmos at night, the awakening of judging forces with the rise of moonlight, the lyrical and mythic evocation of the drama by which the midnight hour emerges. At midnight, quote, at midnight when birds awaken, the north side arouses with a wind. A scepter of the south side stands in its place and strikes that wind. It is then calm and fragrant. Here we have a mode of pastoralism wrapped in metaphysical mystery. The wonder of midnight is abrim with celestial activity, including the delight of the Holy One with the righteous. The description evokes a harmonic confluence of senses, the auditory, the visual, and the olfactory, involving the alternating homiletical voices of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Chizkia, and Rabbi Elazar. The Zohar evokes the ascent of the soul to the heavenly realm while the body is asleep. As Rabbi Chia says, while a person lies asleep, his soul leaves him and testifies about him. This is the time of night. This is, end quote. And now this is me again. This is the time of night when the Holy One descends to the Garden of Eden to delight with the souls of the righteous, and the force of divine emanation flows down onto he who rises at this hour to study the mystical secrets of the Torah. As the homiletical narrator makes clear through the interplay of dialogic exchange, the Kabbalist who wakes at midnight emulates the Holy One, blessed be he, the streams of divine blessing course through him as inspiration and illumination. Maybe one more. This section is from chapter 2, called Encounters Along the Way, and it's part of a long section where I study different scenes of the outdoor wanderings of the Zoharic characters, because right? As I'll say here, so much of the Zohar takes place out of doors in the natural world, which itself is enormously fascinating. And part of what I study here is how certain types of mystical insights, actually specific Kabbalistic associations, happen specifically in the natural world and prompted by particular things that they see and sense. Oh, and here we have our word of the evening, pericope. It is one of my favorites. I do admit it. I am Eitan and I love the word pericope. Our next pericope, page 163, further evokes the power of natural experience to stimulate reflection on the supernatural, expanding the lyrical evocation of the pastoral setting and its particular significance for the mystical path of the disciples. This time it is the voice of Rabbi Shimon that structures the rhetoric. Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Abba, and Rabbi Yossi were sitting one day under the trees in the plain facing the Sea of Ginosar, which is Yam Kineret. Rabbi Shimon said, "How lovely is this shade that is spread over us from the trees. We must crown this place with words of Torah." I think that I talk about this here, but those of you for whom that sounds like a playful inversion of the Mishnah, you're absolutely right, because there's a classic Mishnah that says you should not stop studying Mishnah, even if you to say how beautiful is this tree, right? So he's directly inverting it in an attempt to say no. Look at the natural world, and that will teach you about the supernatural realm. That will teach you about God. As we find in a great many Zoharic passages, the fellowship and mystical study of Rabbi Shimon and his disciples is located out of doors. In most of these cases, the homiletical speech happens along the road, capturing a sense of movement that is the stimulus and context for Kabbalistic learning. In the opening of this textual unit, otherwise known as a pericope, the mood is one of pause and stillness. There is a sense of rest and leisure to the scene. Sitting as a group is the dramatic prelude to an exposition of Kabbalistic teaching. We encounter a narrative that lingers on the pastoral experience of the companions, one that is a source of clear delight and pleasure. Rabbi Shimon's exclamation about the loveliness of the shade celebrates the beauty and sensuousness of the location, and he responds to that pleasure with the impulse to crown the place with words of Torah. The mystic reacts to an experience of sensory delight with the desire to offer up Kabbalistic interpretation. For that is his primary form of lyric expression in response to beauty. Such creativity is the way he seeks to capture the wonder of the moment, much like the poet turns to verse. But there is something more in this impulse. There is the implied notion that the space of natural experience is sanctified through words of mystical creativity. Thank you so much. It's such a great pleasure to be with you, and thank you for coming.
Eitan, I hope you'll agree that the highest praise I can offer you this evening is to say that what you just read to us and the words that you shared with us were nothing less than pericopotic. Okay. So now it's your turn. We have a few minutes for your questions to anybody who's up here. So anyone who'd like to ask a question, please.
Thank you. That was wonderful, both the observations and the book. I studied Zohar with Danny Matt. He would have us chant Zohar in Aramaic before we studied. And Daniel's one of my teachers. I'd like to immediately translate your book into Aramaic. So I think it a neo-Aramaic, Atik Yamin Chadishin Ilah, would be fitting. Your magnificent words. Thank you for this book. I'm looking forward to reading it very much, using it with my students. Also, I'm debating whether to get it on tape, you know, digital, so I can walk around in nature with it, because that would be most fitting rather than sit and study. But thank you so much for this. I think we'll all be contributing and inspired by it for years to come. Thank you so much for it. Titchadesh.
Thank you, John.
Did Do you think that it was in any sense subversive, in the sense that it was offering an alternative construction from the Torah and the legalistic approach that was rendered there?
I think very much so, despite the fact that that Kabbalah and Kabbalists, by right, as reflected in their in their term of art, Kabbalah, were also deeply traditional, deeply conservative, right? And but they were also, especially the authors of the Zohar, radically original. And I thought you were going to mention this also, this Sharon, when you were talking about the story of the Levushei Torah, the garments of Torah that's reflected in that story, right? The famous story that many here are familiar with about the idea of don't be taken in by the idea that Torah is just about literalism, right? Realize that actually it's the deepest mysteries about God that are breathing and singing through the words of the text. And actually one of the moments that I found really stunning in the research, or was really exciting, was also encountering in the prelude to Juan Ruiz's Libro de Buen Amor, the Book of Good Love, essentially a statement that you shouldn't think that the meaning of this book that I am giving you, Juan Ruiz, which is about all kinds of debauchery and all kinds of other forms of love, is really to be taken at face value, but rather is to teach you about the mystery of the love of God, which rings out to me as the fact that either the authors of the Zohar were reading Castilian literature, or rather that this was percolating, right? That certainly in terms of when that text emerged, this was percolating in the folk literary culture of the time. So I guess that's a bit of a tangent to what you were saying, but to say that there is a certain radicalism and a certain subversion in the sense of a kind of eruption of new meaning, and saying don't think that the Torah is just what it seems to be, but the Torah is replete with the divine mysteries.
Thank you so much, Eitan. Beautiful words. Looking forward to reading. Do you think it recaptures any of the sweetness of narrative in Tanakh, the Zohar, as a presentation, a representation, a repackaging of some of the deep themes therein? And were there structures that maybe they were even aware of, not aware of, so much that they hung their kippot on, to create these narratives that reach back further than rabbinic literature, that are brought to life, especially the, you know, as you just mentioned about love, Hosea, Shir Shirim, not only quoting the Psukim, but taking the deep structure of the narrative, bringing it to life.
I think it's fair to say, right, you certainly alluded to the reverberations or the influence of rabbinic story, but certainly they were completely saturated with stories of the Tanakh and with the literary texture of the Tanakh. And despite the fact that they said, right, as I just mentioned, despite the fact that they just said, don't think that these are just Sipurin Be'alma, that these are just literal stories, they are really teaching us about God. They also took in their artistry, I think, in deep ways. There's one particular example I'm thinking about was reflecting on on the prophet Elisha and the Shunammite woman and the idea of the ideal of hospitality and so forth. So that was one example where they directly utilized biblical narrative. But the presence of all aspects of the Tanakh just pulse through the Zohar, and every other sentence is an allusion or a quotation.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Let's. Before you go, I just want to say that we've got another book talk next week, Tuesday. Wendy Zierler, a colleague of yours, Sharon's, will be here to speak about her book, Movies and Midrash, Popular Film and Jewish Religious Conversation. So I invite you to come back then. And please don't run. Books are for sale. But this is an academic book. Right, and academic books take a lot of time to produce, and they wind up costing more than other kinds of books. But to put it in perspective, right, it is very important. Right, this is my promotion of academic books.
Thank you, David.
Right, this book is, as you've heard, a window into the art, poetry, and drama of the Zohar. It costs barely more than 3 entrances to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It costs the same as, by the way, you're getting it at the author's discount. It costs the same as an orchestra ticket at the Philharmonic. It costs less than a ticket in the dress circle at the Metropolitan Opera, and it costs way less than an orchestra ticket at the Beacon Theater this week to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Are you going to? What?
Are you going to?
I am going, yeah. What night are you going?
Thursday
night, I'll see you. Okay.
Hey, all right.
Okay. Please let the author make his way to the table. Checks paid to the author are acceptable. Thank you for coming.